Hello and welcome to the Niche Guarda YouTube podcast series. Once again, powered by openbusinesscouncil.org and citiesabc.com. In this series, we've been always portraying people that are changing the world, people that are making us better humans, people that actually can actually help us understand all the challenges we have when it comes to technology, when it comes to everything that makes us better, and as well that actually makes us think, that makes us humanity. And today, of course, I'm very excited because I brought to the podcast two personalities that each of them deserves a couple of podcasts, but as well because they have both achievements as authors, as entrepreneurs, as thought leaders, and as well as personalities in the global arena of technology, thought leadership, entrepreneurship, and academic and research. So I welcome to our series Juliette Powell, that is an author, a television creator with 9,000 live shows plus under her belt, a technologist and sociologist. Juliette has recently co-written a book called The AI Dilemma, Seven Principles for Responsible Technology. That was released precisely 1 month ago in August 2023, which she co-author with Art Kleiner, that as well is joining us here, that brings together insights from engineering, business, government, and social justice perspectives. So the podcast is about these two authors that are going to be talking about both their profiles, their different backgrounds, and as well how they put together this fantastic book that I highly recommend everyone to read, because we all need to understand the principles and we understand the metrics and the areas when it comes to the AI dilemma, because it's the biggest dilemma in history of humanity. So about Juliette. So Juliette had an early career in media and entertainment as a show creator, interviewer, producer, and she has worked with some of the top brands of media worldwide, like Biography, E!, Much Music, CP24 News, CBC TV Networks. And their work has been in focusing on break racial barriers, growing into a technology and society advisory practice. Juliette is the founder and managing partner at Klein & Powell International, a New York City-based consultancy. She's also the founder, researcher, and creator at Turing AI and WeTheData.org, mapping the data economy with Intel Labs. Juliette's consultancy services are sought after by influential organizations, including the United Nations, Microsoft, and Warner Brothers. She promotes digital literacy, critical thinking, and collaboration, and contributes to discussions on the future of the internet and connected society. In her role as keynote speaker and moderator, Juliette has appeared as a commentator on Bloomberg TV, Business News Network, and conference organized by The Economist and the International Financial Organization. And she has as well been doing substantial research at the Columbia University that focuses on responsible AI deployment and ethical data, the exploration. And besides The AI Dilemma, she's the author of 33 Million People in the Room, How to Create Influence and Run a Successful Business with Social Networking, which was published in 2009 by Prentice Hall Financial Times. And she's a graduate in economics from Rotman School of Management, University of Toronto, and the Finance and International Business from McGill University. And she's also the faculty at the New York University. She was the Miss Canada title holder in 1989, the contest's first Black Canadian winner. B. Art Kleiner. So B. Art Kleiner is my second guest today and is together the author of the book, The AI Dilemma. So he's a versatile writer, editor, and entrepreneur, deeply engaged in contemporary business and the technical challenges of today. During his career, he's been involved in a lot of areas, like the Whole Earth Catalog. He led the best-selling The Fifth Discipline Field Book Series as the editor-in-chief of PwC Global and the editor-in-chief Strategy Plus Business of PwC award-winning magazine management magazine with a circulation of 1.3 million. And Art has published some of the bestsellers, including The Age of Heretics. That is a book that I recommend that had two editions. Who Really Matters, that was published initially in 2003, and The Wise Advocate in 2019. Art is an entrepreneur and management thinker who helps leaders build trust, scenario planning, and responsible leverage AI technology. Besides this, his expertise spans human behavior, organizational learning, the future of work, and neuroscience of leadership. He commissioned and published the first major article, Neuroleadership, the Neuroscience of Leadership, by Jeffrey Schwartz and David Rock. Art is the principal and editor-in-chief of Kleiner Paolo International. He recently co-authored, of course, and this is the purpose of this YouTube podcast series, The AI Dilemma, Seven Principles for Responsible Technology, August 2023, with Juliet Powell. And from an education, Art has been as a journalist master's from the UC Berkeley, and Kleiner is a part of Marshall Goldsmith 100 Coaches Group. He's a faculty member of the New York University Interactive Telecommunications Program, part of the School of Arts, where he taught the future of new media. So, Juliet and Art, we are welcome you to the club.
Thank you.
Very much so.
So, Juliet, let's start with the ladies. So you have a fantastic career that spans from television to technology, sociology, and as well, author. So tell us a bit, how did it start? It start with your parents? It start with your passion? What made your humanity?
What made my humanity? Oh, what a fantastic question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that before. I would say absolutely genetics has a lot to do with it. My mother was an incredibly intelligent and beautiful woman, very kind, very generous. And she really wanted me to feel like a citizen of the world. And so she made sure that I had dual citizenship, American and Canadian. She made sure that I had two languages of birth, so English and French. And she also made sure that I have, you know, a very mixed background. My father was African-American, my mother French-Canadian, with, you know, some German, Scottish, some even say some Polish thrown in there. So I would say that I started out in this life all mixed up with an openness to community building. And I was lucky enough to get into television at a very young age because I saw somebody being interviewed on television, and it was a horrible interview. And I thought, oh my gosh, okay, I think I can actually do better than that. And the television network seemed to agree, even though I didn't have a degree in this space at all. I had a vision of what could be done with live television. And interestingly enough, for me, it really prepared me for the internet. I started coding when I was a teenager while I was on television. And so to be able to see the back-end interactions, how things are done when you do it online versus live on television is an incredible advantage, which also allowed me to understand social data from a very, very young age. And then when I finally moved to New York, it became very, very apparent that social media was taking over and that those that didn't get it were really missing out. And so I ended up writing a book called 33 Million People in the Room. That was my first book. I didn't even realize that I could be taken seriously as an author. But people like Jimmy Wales were kind enough to write the foreword for the book. He, of course, is the founder of Wikipedia. And in that book predicted some pretty astonishing things. For instance, the first internet president, Obama's rise, but also Trump's rise because of the same tools. And so anyway, fast forward, I was fortunate enough to work with Intel Labs, mapping the personal data ecosystem on a global level, which made me understand how much personal data has an impact on all of us, how much of it is monetized, what it's used for in general. And that, of course, led me to AI and really focusing in on the socio-technical systems and how we as humans shape them, but also how they shape us. And Art was kind enough throughout several years to, you know, he was the editor-in-chief at Strategy and Business at PwC. And, you know, often I'd bounce some ideas off of him. And he one day asked if he could see my dissertation at Columbia, and it was on the limits and possibilities of self-regulation and artificial intelligence, which can be the driest topic in the world. But Art was kind enough to read through it and said, "You have a book here." And there you have it.
Oh, that's amazing, and amazing as well your background and the wealth of cultural, and as well that creates really very strong humanity. Let's put it that way. Art, about you, because you have as well a fantastic humanity. What defines yours?
My parents were school teachers in and around New York. I also had a younger brother who was autistic, and that shaped a lot of the way I look at things. When, as early as age 8, I knew I wanted to be a professional writer because I was such an avid reader. And I went to journalism school. While I was at journalism school, I heard about this odd thing called computer communications. At the time, they called it, but it was email. And I went to work for the Whole Earth Catalog right around the time that Silicon Valley was emerging with the third wave with the personal computer. Whole Earth covered that. I ended up covering, you know, being in charge of a lot of their computer coverage. I discovered that behind every technology story is a business story. And behind every business story is a culture story. And I moved back to New York and started writing about and editing about the new wave of management thinking, which had a lot to do with the counterculture values that I had seen in San Francisco. And I ended up writing a book called The Age of Heretics, which is about the hidden movement to change corporations for the better from the inside, for the better from the inside. We now call that participative management, or just we call it good management now. At the time, it was rebellious and hidden, a lot of it. I went on from there, as Juliet said, to edit Strategy and Business and to write a few more books. And when I saw I saw your dissertation, it wasn't just the topic, but it was the perspective, you know, being able to look at this technology. It's been emerging for, you know, 50, 100, you know, 60 years, and being able to see the thread, you know, that it's finally crossing a threshold in which it won't be able to be ignored. And that's one reason why I thought the book was so clearly, you know, so clearly a book that was needed, and was very gratified and privileged to be asked to co-author it.
Well, both of you are really, I would like to do a separate interview with each of them in the future, because definitely there's so much to talk. And first, you have all the books, Who Really Matters, 2003, and The Wise Advocate, 2019. So coming back to you before the book, and I have a lot of questions about the book. So Juliet, coming back to you, one of the projects you have so much projects, but one of the projects that is really amazing is the project you did with data, which is very impressive on that project. And of course, you had a huge change in a lot of different things. So on the project that you did, especially, of course, you work in Kleiner Powell International and different projects, but especially you work in television and as well then doing the research in AI. During this work, especially starting, like you said, you mentioned Obama and you mentioned Trump. They both were two examples of the extremes you can go using data. And at the time, it was purely just basic social media, not at the moment, but you can do. So how do you see this kind of, I would say, the narrative and as well the path? Because it's been kind of an accelerator, talking about 10 years. And in 10 years, definitely for us, of course, we are so much immersed that you forget this, but it's like coming from the Stone Age to some kind of spatial development. And definitely this is happening right now in a big velocity. So this sense of velocity and what you learn, for instance, especially the project I was mentioning is, so he was the founder, researcher, and creator of Turing AI and with data.org, where you map the data economy with Intel Labs. So if you could talk about this project in particular, because of course it's a key element for what you're doing right now.
Well, I was very fortunate in so many ways in my life. When I was still in television, the founder of TED, Richard Saul Wurman, came to get me. I was living in Toronto at the time, and he said, come to the TED conference and meet everyone and help me produce it. And through that process, got to know an extraordinary community that I'm sure that you're very aware of. But I also got a chance to really understand in a very visceral way how many people that go on that TED stage are just human, right? They're just human and they get nervous like the rest of us before going on stage. And they tend to share very personal things when they're having heart to hearts, even if it's with pure strangers, because sometimes strangers feel a little bit safer than the people that know us well, because they won't use the information against us. And through that TED process, I was asked to become a TED mentor. And one of my mentees, the wonderful Eric Berlow, asked me to come in and speak with Intel Labs and see if we could curate something different. Intel Labs had been trying to map the personal data ecosystem on a global level for the past 5 years, and they had spent millions of dollars doing it. And the first thing that I noticed is that they had only interviewed people within Intel. And it seems to me that if you really want to understand what's going on in the world, you have to go out to the world and find out, talk to some of those other people. And so it became very clear that part of mapping the overall strategy to be able to truly meet the requirements of the task, we had to go outside of our comfort zone. And using social media and our, you know, connections, we connected with people like Bill Joy and John Perry Barlow from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And we started asking them, who should we be speaking to? Not just the usual suspects, but who in the world is really making a difference in terms of all things data? And so we were able to collect a list and realize that many of the people that were participants in this space didn't necessarily know each other. They came from different parts of the world. Some were for-profit, some were nonprofit, some were governmental. And the opportunity to really tap into all of these minds simultaneously was important. So Eric Berlow and his team had come up with a tool, and we were trying to convince people to use this tool in order to map things immediately. And we got too much pushback. People weren't interested in using tools. They wanted to connect with each other. And so we decided a different strategy. Okay, what would happen if we were all to meet physically in one place? And in this case, I chose the TED conference because so many people actually want to come to this conference, and many of them were already coming. And at the same time, we had access to the TED Fellows. And so bringing these incredible people together in one place proved to be the perfect secret sauce, because all of a sudden you'd have, you know, one data scientist talking about their experience in a very specific context. But because of the nature of TED, you've got people, you know, that are coming and going all around them, and they'd stop and listen in on the conversation. And the next thing you know, they'd be jumping in. Wait a minute, what about this and that? So now you have like three and four data scientists that are discussing the various elements of the data ecosystem, and what does it require and what's important. We were trying to find the four grand challenges that were necessary so that everyone in the world could really benefit from our personal data, as opposed to only, you know, the companies and the governments that are controlling our personal data. And what we came up with through this process of kind of matching people together and challenging each other was we got some great video, but we also got a bunch of people that became heavily invested in this idea of making personal data ownership for all, which is something that I don't think any of us really understood or thought about prior to the project itself. Because, you know, you get caught up in your own silo and you're focused on your own work. You're not necessarily thinking about the world and how to make it better, you know, 24/7. But in this case, and perhaps also because of the setting of these meetings, it became very clear that once we started mapping, that there would be four grand challenges. So one is, you absolutely need digital infrastructure, right? If you don't have digital infrastructure, then you can't really participate in the personal data revolution. Once you have digital infrastructure, do you have access to it, right? Which is not something that we can necessarily take for granted anymore. I think many of us in the G8 countries do, but that's just not the case around the world and in many communities, even in G8 countries. The other thing that you needed was data literacy. How many people do you know that do not work in tech actually have data literacy? It's hard enough to have digital literacy, right? And then finally, we needed to have trust in these systems, trust in the infrastructure, trust in the stakeholders that are involved in that ecosystem. And what we also found beyond these four grand challenges is that they all needed to be nourished simultaneously for more people around the world to have access to and benefit from the personal data revolution. So here we are several years later, and I can't say that we've necessarily been able to bolster that four challenge ecosystem in a way that's really equitable for all, especially with the pandemic, as you can imagine.
You touched, it's actually one of the areas I wanted to touch. So from the digital infrastructure, the digital readiness to the data literacy and trust, which are the key elements actually for anything humanity at the moment. So Art, I want, before to go into the book, and the book actually touched this as well, but one question I have, because your career has been between writing, managing consulting, and business, and technology. So you had, in one end, we have a bridge between the two worlds that sometimes are very divided. And I think that's what the beauty about both of you is, Juliette, as both the strategical, theoretical, and as well, of course, an achievement. And Art, you've been actually always bridging between the two. So from your experience in working, of course, in one of the biggest organizations in the world, with PwC, and as well as an entrepreneur and as a technologist and as a writer, how do you see what Juliette just mentioned, and before we go to the book and AI?
Well, so as Juliette, as soon as you said, you know, I learned at the TED Talks that everybody is just another person, not just another person, but another person with all of the individual habits and attitudes and deep-seated predispositions that they bring. Well, you know, that's one of the things I learned at a company like PwC. And I went there after working at Booz Allen Hamilton and then at a startup called Booz & Company, which was another small management consultancy. So I was at a number of business organizations that were all oriented to consulting. And I did, most of the consulting I did was around scenarios, working with people to look at potential futures. And everybody wants to figure out what's likely, what's the most, you know, probable thing, and then I'll go and solve that problem. But actually, the challenge that we face with scenarios is much like the challenge we face with AI today, which is, how do we make decisions now that will be okay no matter what future comes to pass? We honestly don't know yet, Dennis, whether, you know, many jobs will be lost or whether more jobs will be created. We just don't know yet. We don't know, you know, we know there will be risks, and we know that human beings will adapt to this new world. We know that it will be significantly different, that it will require adaptation, just like the smartphone created a world that was so significantly different that it required adaptation. What we don't know yet are the details of which adaptations are going to be important. And so, you know, our job now as decision makers, as, you know, listeners and viewers of your podcast, as anybody working in a company or a creative person, is to say, what do I do now so that no matter what happens, I'll feel good about it when I look back 5 years ago from now and say, this is what I chose.
Oh, that's a key word, is how can we get there? So I know that that doing the process of research for this book, things are moving very fast. Okay, I'm sure that when you start researching, you would not expect even that. I think the consensus worldwide is that right now AI is sentient. So, and it's something that everyone would speak probably for 2045, 2050. So we are probably 25 years or 27, a bit earlier. And secondly, as well, is that, of course, we have a huge right now, I would say, confusion about the perceptions of velocity, the perception of what can happen. And you mentioned, of course, the jobs destruction. And if you look at the perspective of the fourth industrial revolution that we're going through, or society 5.0, the concept more from created by the Japanese government, that became a global standard with a super intelligent society. In some ways we are there, but in some ways we're not there. So from a statistics perspective, we are probably better than ever in history of humanity from a general kind of mainstream metrics. But because, of course, we live more, we have extended lives and capacities. But of course, there's a perception that there's a fragmentation of ideas, values, even definitions like democracy and so forth. And this is nothing new. If you look at history, things keep changing. And I think, Juliet, you mentioned the tech talk, which is one of the biggest exponential part of the thinking of humanity, which is amazing what they achieved. And that as well, in your books, you've been talking a lot about this thing. So before you go to the book, and it is part of my preliminary part, so from your experience, and I would like the question for each of you, I think one of the biggest challenges definitely right now, the physical world and digital world merged. And partly it's not different from what we had in the books, let's say when the book was created or paper was created, which was probably the first mainstream technology. No one speaks about the technology of paper. We talk about fire, but not paper, because paper was the first time we can put writing, papyrus or something like that. But one of the questions is, okay, this physical and virtual is, in the end of the day, everything passes in our mind, and then our mind pushes emotions and the physical interactions, even if it's virtual and so forth. So from this experience and your experiences as both, of course, high successful individuals, but as well working with companies, organizations, and institutions, how do you see this kind of velocity and how this, I would say probably in your lives, first of all, because in the end of the day, this is all personal. And for instance, Art, in your case, you mentioned your family and your brother that grew up with a very sensitive disease that changes the life of anyone, because you have to deal with this and it's part of your life. Sometimes it's invisible, but at the same time shows the fragility of life. And of course, when I talk about unicorns and we talk about technology, we always think about macro craziness. So I would like to go to the humanity part. So from this perception, probably starting with you, Juliet, you work with the data organization, you work with the TED Talks, you work with television. And as well, you've been researching AI. So it's a lot of evolving things that are right now all interrelated. You cannot separate them. So how do you see this affecting your personal life? And then yours starts the same question.
I was in Thailand in 1995. And I remember seeing a couple on the beach. The man was American and he was writing software that translated English to Japanese, and his partner was Japanese and she was doing the opposite. And they had connected through their work, had fallen in love, and had decided to move to Phuket to live the dream. They essentially had a beautiful hut on the beach where they lived, and they would work from the beach. I think it was from 7 a.m. until 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon. They were getting paid in Japanese yen. And if you've been to Thailand, you know that the baht is is not very strong compared to the yen, let alone the U.S. dollar or the euro. So they were really living what I considered to be such an idyllic life, to be able to do what you love, where you want, with the person that you want. You weren't restrained by your nationality, or it was this hybrid world that I aspired to live in. And so that was my goal in life. I was going to figure out how I was going to make myself happy in that way. And didn't know whether the partner would come, but certainly I kind of set the pieces in motion so that I could start working that way. And from a very young age, again, I was coding. I was doing a lot of remotes when I worked in television. You know, you're live from various places. I mean, I remember in 1996 being live on the internet at, I think it was 16 frames per second, right? So if you're doing anything, it's 16 frames per second, you're going like this, your video is all horrible. But at the time, it was just so incredibly innovative. Like all of a sudden, you didn't have to build an entire television network to be able to broadcast. You could just broadcast on the internet. So again, having these seeds in my mind from a very young age, it became clear that this lifestyle was possible. And so I've been essentially living the dream for a very long time. When I moved to New York in 2002, I endeavored that I would never have a physical office as most people do, that I'd be able to work using my laptop, using my phone from anywhere in the world. And most of my collaborators, most of my teammates are people that I know very, very well, that we've worked together for a very long time. But for the most part, we do everything remotely, and we've been doing things remotely for probably the last 20 years. The writing of the book with Art is a great example of that. I mean, he and I at that time were in very different locations. I was in New York and he was in Connecticut. And, you know, it happened maybe two or three times where we actually physically met in person. And you know what we did then? We really went analog, where we started writing down our ideas, and we had all of these stick-it pads, giant stick-it pads on the back before entering it, you know, into a system online so that we could better work remotely. But that human touch, that physical connection, where sometimes we could not necessarily come to terms through digital means, when we're in the same room, we were able to do it. And of course, that also means, you know, having meals together or also sharing personal things. My dog was there. So I think that that humanity for me manifests through the digital because I'm surrounded by wonderful people, like whole people, human people. And so when one is down, the other one's up, and we act as batteries to each other, and the digital realm enables it. But I think more and more, I'm also connecting with people that I've never met in person and working with them. And maybe because I've gotten used to that flow, it's just a joy. And it's a joy also to see now, especially coming back from so many horrible things that happened during the pandemic, more and more people are discovering this freedom, this ability, and putting their foot down and saying, you know what? This is my life too. And yes, I want to help your company, but I also want to have a life. And I think that that's part of it, being able to actually have choices as opposed to constantly being imposed by society, by your relationships, the way that you should and should not act. There is freedom in disconnection through digital.
Amazing. Art.
So there's really four dimensions. There's the physical world, the tangible world of stuff. There's the larger world of structures and invisible things like organizations. There's the digital world where we are, you know, increasingly, you know, as you say, Juliet, we are our personal data, and where we are continuing to meet and interact. And then there's the inner world. And I think all four of them are interconnected. I was thinking about what the theme is for my life overall, and it really is that I live to understand. I always think there's an actual answer out there, and I've had to learn with a lot of battering against this reality that there is, you know, the answer, whatever it is going to be withheld from us. It's not evident if there is one. But what is evident is the connection between what we think, what we do, how we interact, and then what our organizations do, and then what happens to us in the digital world. Those are all interwoven. And so, you know, I'm a little skeptical of, for instance, people who say, you know, AI is going to end humanity, or AI is going to, you know, take everybody's jobs, because that assumes that people don't think, react, and act in ways that are not necessarily in concert, but that in ways that are systems. They're systematic, and and I also don't believe that people are static in the way they react. And so, you know, you opened by asking about, you know, humanity, Dennis, and I think humanity is a moving target. The only other thing I'll add with, you know, this whole barrier between physical and inner and technological, every morning I work out for 2 hours. I do this in concert with people, and I have a, it's probably the only routine I've ever had in my life. and where I do a certain thing at a certain time. And as a result, I've changed. That's because I'm very keenly aware of the way in which the physical body affects how we connect with each other and what we do technologically, and even, you know, our ability to keep up with ideas and with answers to the question, how does it really work? It's all connected. It's, you know, very few of us have the discipline and energy to make it all work on all these levels all the time. But I think that's one of the challenges of living today, is to try to make as much go well as you can on the physical dimension, the inner dimension, the intellectual dimension, and on the dimension of participating in conversations like this one.
Well, it's a wealth of things here that we can take, and it has been I'm thinking a lot of the open doors that what you just said opened. So let's go to the book. And of course, I have much more questions to individual, but let's start with the book because this is about the book. So for people listening to us, so The AI Dilemma, 7 Principles for Responsible Technology. And this is the first edition. I think it will be probably a second one because it's a very important book. So, and the foreword by Esther Dyson, founder of Wellville. So in terms of these 7 principles, and I really suggest everyone to listen and actually buy the book and get into the book, because this is very important. So when I look at your synopsis of the book, and when I look at a lot of things about the book, there's a lot of different areas of structure. There's a lot of questions around this. So you start by introduction, machines, what make life or death choices, that make life or death choices. And let's start by, and this comes, of course, from your own research, Juliet, initially with Intel Labs and different parts that brought all of this together. So how did you work together in finding these 7 principles, and how do you put the book together? Let's start by the genesis.
Well, again, so I went back to school, and at Columbia, my dissertation was incredibly dense. It was quite unreadable in many ways. And it did not contain any principles. It was very much trying to answer the question, what are the limits and possibilities of self-regulation in artificial intelligence, and looking specifically at big tech, and realizing that this self-regulation, as much as a company wants to self-regulate when they first start, just like when we start a company, you have all these ideals of what you want to do, all the good stuff that you want to do with the world. But ultimately, I think that as competition comes in, as additional pressures from shareholders, as you scale and so on and so forth, the competition to be the number one AI provider in the world when there are only 3, that changes what self-regulation looks like. And so then getting back into all of the regulation that's been proposed around AI from a global perspective, I think that I was so focused on that and on the stories that were shared with me from people that I've known in some cases for 20, 30 years. Others were referred to me by these same people, but invariably this, as much as they're techno-optimists, this fear and this underlying dread. And I think that I was a little too close to it to really be able to think about it in terms of principles. And that's where art came in. So I came in with 4 logics around artificial intelligence power, right? So you've got the governmental logic, you've got the corporate logic, you've got the engineer's logic, clearly, and then you've got the social justice logic. But looking at it from there, I realized that those 4 logics need to be integrated for us to be able to create artificial intelligence that works for the majority of people and not just some of the people. That, I think, was the starting point to really digging in deeper as to what these different principles might be. And they changed several times. I know that Art really wanted to throw in this idea of do no harm, right? The Hippocratic Oath. And the more we tested that idea with actual engineers that worked in the field, the less it made sense. One of the reasons for that is because engineers, when you're talking about, you know, mechanical engineers, for example, or electrical engineers, there's a whole training and retraining that comes with this business of being accredited as an engineer. And when people die, you are held accountable. When you are a computer engineer, it's a very different set of criteria. And, you know, when people die, and perhaps in the past, I don't know to what extent, you know, the law necessarily associated the engineer with the end result of harm to humans. But either way, there is no real dedication right now to making computer engineers responsible in the same way that a mechanical engineer would be responsible for what they're building. And I think that's an opportunity. I think this is something that we definitely need to develop. But from this idea of do no harm that we really couldn't enforce, came up with the idea of risk, intentional risk to humans, and started thinking about what that potential calculus of intentional risk could be for anybody that's either developing AI or using AI, or anybody in between. And anyway, that took on different dimensions and really came out of conversations with people that work within big tech specifically, and specifically those that really, really do care about responsible technology. They've chosen to work within these larger organizations because they want to have a positive impact. They believe in the organization. They believe in the potential of the technology itself if deployed in a certain way. So the calculus of intentional risk really came from what these people are telling these larger organizations to allow them to slow down, to allow them not to be driven purely by the profit imperative, and to realize that if there is human harm, that human harm not only hurts people, but also your reputation, which in the case of a large company like a Google or a Microsoft is potentially billions of people. So that responsibility is much bigger than if you're a small startup that is doing great tech. But, you know, if you've only got 100,000 users, that's a very different equation in terms of risk and impact. So that's one side of the principles. But Art, I'd love to hear your perspective.
Well, this is great. So you can, just to stay on risk for a moment, the first one, we called it be intentional about risk because you can't avoid risk. You can't, if you're working with AI, there are going to be possibilities of overreach. There are going to be unintended consequences by the nature of automated technology. So you have to choose what kind of risks you want to take. And you have to choose how you organize the oversight. And then that leads to the other principles. The principles basically emerged from taking all the material we had gathered and grouping them according to what effect would they have. You know, how does this change a decision that somebody might make? So for instance, there were a lot of sticky notes about secrets and accountability in terms of, can I find out what that AI program is doing? Well, no, you can't, because it's machine learning and it doesn't keep track of how it learned to recognize a cat any more than a toddler can tell you how the toddler learned to recognize a cat. It did it by iteration after iteration. So what can you query? Well, you can query the closed box of the organization, people, and technology together, the socio-technical system that created the AI. But then you have to ask, why did you create this program in the first place? And which data did you gather? And what were your rules for data gathering? And what did you tell the model in terms of bias and all these other things? So suddenly, you're asking for you, the querier, the person who cares, are asking for information that is otherwise known as trade secrets. And you're into the whole realm of organizational learning, which enters into, you know, how open should an organization be? So it's a principle. It's be as open as you can be without compromising your organization. Why? Not because you're following some abstract principle, but because it's going to get back to the harm that your system might do if you're not intentional about the risk. And the others, you know, we have one about personal data and, you know, reclaim individual ownership of personal data and how great it would be if we all owned our data. We have one about bias, recognizing that all human activity is biased in some way, but you can be intentional about how you confront bias, question bias, and prevent it from overtaking the machine. We have one about the organizational structures and whether they are tightly woven or loosely woven systems and how that relates to the complexity of what they're governing. We have one about accountability itself and the mechanisms for accountability and what kinds of things need to be audited versus what kinds of things need to be set up to compensate people who have been wronged or harmed. And then we have, you know, we ended up by saying, well, what's left? And we looked at our own process of working together and the process, you know, most really effective creative processes. And we called the last of the principles, embrace creative friction, because there is a way in which raising the things that feel uncomfortable in a safe and generative and kind way can lead to breakthroughs that are financial breakthroughs, but also breakthroughs in terms of human consequence. So, you know, once we started with the idea of let's organize around principles, it seemed pretty natural to the way they played out. And we took them, you know, we haven't said this before, I don't think, but there are about 150 principles out there. There's a huge number of principles that have been put out by various organizations. And we looked at them. I won't say we looked at them in detail, but we certainly scanned them. And these were the ones that were consistently, clearly evident.
So before we go, I have a lot of questions about the book, but I have to make this is again for you, Art, but I have to go there. So because your book, one of your best sellers that has two editions, the heresy. So I think that is actually more important than ever. So if you look at that, and I want to touch this question with both of you, because in the end of the day, in your second edition of the reinvented corporate management and the age of heretics, there's an interesting article I pick about you. So in your book, you define as effective, the nature of effective leadership in times of change. It's defined by the importance of the corporation and how the corporation manages things. And your concept of heretic, and of course I'm quoting after quoting and so forth, so forgive me for the details, is a heretic is a visionary who creates change in large-scale companies, balancing the contrary truths they can't deny against their loyalty to their organizations. So in the end of the day, all the people in technology, that's they are heretics, including myself. And I think you as well, both of you. So because in the end of the day, we're breaking concepts to push things. Of course, the point here right now is if you look at Christianity and the concept of heretic, it's the person that broke the trust of the church. And in this case, is how we break this with some sense of principles that you define in your book, or without the sense of principles. And of course, the principles are open. We just open a Pandora box. So picking in this concept of heretic, and as well looking how we're going to be defining even the way we can take forward this new tool, because AI is a new tool. And I think we can see it as a tool or set of tools, or you can see it as an evolution of humanity. And I think probably the latter is actually more realistic because it's already learning and evolving somehow what we are as humans, but we are making it. So it's our baby as well. So I want to see how both of you look at this, because of course this your book actually opened this, and now you have another one about principles. So it's a very interesting, put the two things together. I like to provoke in a constructive way.
Maybe I should start. I wrote The Age of Heretics after watching Bertolt Brecht's play Galileo. And Galileo, you know, one of the great heretic figures in Western civilization, was a very devout Catholic, a very devout member of the church, and he never wanted to leave the church. Kepler would left the church, but Galileo, he went to figure after figure, and he had a lot of friends in the papacy. And he went to them and said, will you just look through the telescope, so you can win. What he had to show them through the telescope was earth shaking. It was that humanity, human beings are not the center of the universe. Pretty shocking. and they knew, you know, the church leaders knew, and Galileo would not leave. He, even at the cost of his own house arrest, and he, you know, spent his life trying to bring these two worlds together. Now, when I wrote The Age of Heretics, I did not yet work for a large corporation. And I then went on to work at one. And I recognized that there is a transactional nature between corporations and the people who work for them, and that the company will move in service of its priorities, and its priorities are partly shareholder value and all that stuff, and partly what people perceive the leaders of the company to want. And that's very strong. And being someone positioned in opposition, you learn to play a game that is going to get you pretty far towards pulling both of those things together, but not all the way. And, you know, the tech world in particular has a lot of examples of people who played the game up to a point and then said, no, I just can't stay here, and found an alternative. In some cases, they had made enough money that they could walk away without having to worry about their, you know, their livelihood. In other cases, they took the leap, hoping that they would have a soft landing. That is part of the heretic story in our time. I think there are many people, I know some people in large companies still working to change them for the better. And I know many people who have left. And in the responsibility and responsible technology gambit that we believe is going to be inevitable, that's going to have to happen, I think both groups of people play a role. Often a hidden role on the heretic side.
Juliet, I would like to hear.
I wondered when we were writing the book if we shouldn't kind of piggyback on that Age of Heretics. We talked about it, and we talked about it with our publisher as well, because of all the heretics that were reaching out to us specifically about artificial intelligence and what they were seeing, not just in their day-to-day jobs, but some of the data that was running on the back end of the servers. I mean, I spoke to people that I've known for a very long time about, you know, literally seeing data that confirmed that some sex trafficking was happening, that confirmed that pedophilia was happening, that confirmed like all of our worst nightmares. And they would report it back to people like me, because they didn't feel like they could go talk to their boss about it, because their boss said that they didn't want to know. Why didn't their boss want to know? Because they didn't want the companies to have liabilities. Like, to me, that is just, as somebody who has never worked in that kind of a large organization, I've consulted, I go in, I do my job, I go out, right? So I'm much less shaped by the organization than somebody like Art that's, you know, stay somewhere for 15, 20 years. And so to me, these heretics not putting their foot down, not saying I refuse to do this if they truly feel that their own humanity is at play here, is shocking. I think it was a lot less shocking for Art. I remember asking Art something about his friends at one point. And he said, I don't have any friends. I said, what do you mean you don't have any friends? Well, I realize that all of my relationships are transactional. So these are learned behaviors within the organization that I suspect that the higher you go up, the more you're retrained with more and more socialization to fit that particular level, that particular role, that particular responsibility. And now that Art is working with me at a much smaller organization, I think you're having to retrain yourself again, to stop thinking so transactionally and to start actually recognizing that we as humans, we're all in this together. We really are, especially, again, coming out of a global pandemic, the realities of where AI is going, how quickly it's going there, and how we have to tap into our humanity now if we don't want it to overpower us.
Yeah, I agree with that. Everything. However, I will say that a number of people I worked with would probably be hurt to hear me say, you know, that I didn't have any friends. I think I did have or do have true friends. But there always was a transactional element as long as we were drawing a paycheck from the same employer. I think that we were able to build, and I think people do at work all the time. However, I also agree that AI, you know, it freezes the best of us and the worst of us, amplifies it and automates it. So it becomes a little bit of a forcing function for self-examination. And, you know, we, again, it's uncertain how much that will affect what leaders of big tech companies or other companies do. But in some ways, it's already having an effect. Leaders are now going online and saying, you know, we want this type of regulation. We recognize, you know, some leaders, you know, have signed that petition for, you know, a 6-month hiatus on research. It didn't happen because of the four, you know, the four power coordinates that you mentioned, Juliet. But it's in the air in a way that I think the nature of AI makes that happen. Blockchain isn't the same kind of forcing function. The metaverse doesn't have that same kind of all-encompassing sense of the Sorcerer's Apprentice. This really does.
So coming back to the book, so in the middle of all these ideas that it's what really makes the complexity of our world and as well the opportunities. So to reach these seven principles, there's a lot of work. There's a lot of thinking, because in the end of the day, we can go through the United Nations SDG, Sustainable Developing Goals. We can actually go through a lot of different areas that are kind of mainstream. And of course, in history, there was always moments of risk, moments of heresy, moments as well that shift humanity for good and for bad. And actually, there's in one of the biographies that I love from Vasari, from Leonardo da Vinci, and actually the three he did, there's a certain point, I'm going to quote by memory, but he was saying that there's moments when ideas and art work together with money. There's ideas when technology or ideas work with power, and then there's military and power. So we are in the kind of a bridge, because at the same time, this, of course, in the end of the day, the elephant in the room, no one can ignore it. Of course, AI is, it's an with a power that we never saw anything. And effectively, even a chat GPT-3, I'm not even 4, can already kind of write an entire book. If with a couple of, especially with people like us, of course, it's very basic in a lot of ways. It can fake a lot of different things. But effectively, it processes information like any human, at least language. Let's put it that way. That's why it's called generative language. But during this process of research for these principles, how do you summarize in 7 principles? I would like to see how you reach the 7 principles. And of course, the idea is not to give away the book. It's open, the ideas for reading the book. But what would be the principles that you reach to, or the summary capacity? Because there's a lot of work to get to this summary that you achieved in the book.
Well, how should we structure this? Should we divide them?
Oh, go ahead, Art. I'm very curious to see how you're going to answer the question.
Okay. Sorry, my questions are all too big.
No, this is great. No, because I've given this, I think, thought for a lot longer. But in terms of actually breaking down the principles, I think one of the strengths was that Art and I think so differently. So it was a constant back and forth where many times we didn't agree, and we had to come back and reiterate and be patient with each other. So how would you summarize the 7 that we came up with?
Be intentional about risk is choose the approach you take to what you release and what you use, so that you are thinking about the consequences intentional and unintended, and making choices about how much of those consequences you will tolerate and how you will avoid the negative ones. All of them, there's a lot to unpack, but that to me is the basics. Open the closed box is make as much as possible explainable. Maybe parse, who it's explainable to in certain cases, but allow for there to be a way to find out why this program was generated, what the logic was behind its choices, including how the data was selected and massaged, and what the model was intended to do. And include in that the gap between what the intention of the model is and the actual outcome of the model. And why does that gap exist? Then the third one is confronting question bias. And there, I think humanity is biased. We're all biased. And to what extent can we safely and capably raise awareness of the biases that are there and eliminate or reduce the harmful effects that bias has, negative bias in particular, to groups of people who might be excluded or ostracized or, harmed because of biases against them, but not just biases against people, biases against types of action, any bias that limits the value that we provide with AI. And then, reclaim ownership of data. This is the way I think of it is, how great would it be if you had some simple app that could just say, I want my data to be used here. It goes only so long. I don't want it to be used there. I want it to be used there with this nuance under these circumstances. And since you're paying for it to be marketed, I want a cut of it. And I want that to go into this bank account and make it easy. Make it as easy for me to control my data and have, options for my data as you make it easy for me to give away my data. Accountability is really what mechanisms can we put in place so that people who misuse the technology, either deliberately or through carelessness, or because that's just not what we're thinking about, or I'm delegating that to the risk department and not thinking about it again. What can we bring to bear to make sure that people feel the accountability? How would they compensate those who have been hurt or those who have been shut out because of it? And accountability is part awareness and part action and then part regulation. And then the loosely coupled and tightly coupled systems, the phrase comes from Charles Perrow, who studied nuclear power disasters. And this, to me, this is totally related to organizational design. I've worked for loosely coupled organizations and I've worked for tightly coupled organizations. And, I'd rather be rich in my coupling. I'd rather have loosely coupled systems where, you push a few dominoes over and the whole thing doesn't collapse, but where you have designs that allow for multiple ways of thinking about things and for fail-safe mechanisms that come into play. And then creative friction. This came from a few places, including some of the people that you worked with, Juliet, and who practiced it. But to me, it comes also back to the concept of frictionlessness. And I had kind of gotten used to wanting the world to be as frictionless as possible. There's a very popular book on user experience design called Don't Make Me Think. And I wanted to choose what I thought about and not think about what I didn't want to think about. One of the things I didn't want to think about was the software I used. I wanted it to be totally intuitive to the way I worked, or I just wasn't interested. That worked as long as I worked for a large corporation where the software was tailored to a common set of attitudes and ways of looking at things. When I left and was on my own, I had to pay attention for the first time in many years to the design of what was around me. I had to think about it. It was no longer frictionless. And therefore, that was a rude awakening, and in some ways, a recognition of the way life is for most people and will probably be for all of us. Just because we have AI doesn't mean things are going to be frictionless now. In fact, quite the opposite. Now we're going to have to choose between 17 different life organizers and decide which one really fits, if we use one at all.
Julia, do you want to add on this? Because I think it's an important consideration. I would like to hear from both of you. And I completely subscribe to what you said, Art, but it's really opens a lot of questions, but I'll try to synthesize my next one.
Well, certainly, let me jump in on the creative friction part. So again, I think that we threw in creative friction specifically because Art and I had massive creative friction as we were writing about frictionlessness and this idea of control. And I think that the idea that we are more in control because we have our digital devices, because we have a big buy button that we can press, and that, you know, essentially we allocate our decision making to systems that decide where we're going to live, who we're going to date, you know, whether we quit our jobs or don't quit our jobs. We delegate a lot of important decisions to these systems. And at the same time, we don't necessarily do the cost-benefit analysis that's necessary to truly be in control of something. You're just kind of ad hoc picking things on the fly, but you're not giving deep thought to it. And so one of the people that was just really inspiring in terms of an interview as we were wrapping up the book is with Professor Sheena Iyengar. She's at Columbia Business School, and she's done a lot of research on this, research on what real control is and how it's a biological need that we all have. But again, as two authors who are trying to deliver something on deadline because we have a contract with a publisher, there was a lot of creative friction in how we were going to do that and both be satisfied with the results of the book. And so I went back to yes, the way that we worked in television, for example, where in Canada, I grew up with a very small television network, and just about everybody had actually studied television. I didn't. As I said, I saw somebody do an interview and I just jumped in. And there was always this collaborative effort within the organization because you had the business side, you had the creative side, you had the fact that you were live, you had the advertisers. And so it was always this push and pull of how best to optimize in a live environment to give out the best product for everyone. And those lessons stayed with me so that when I started, for example, speaking with my friends in big tech, and I started asking, like, how do you make decisions about responsibility and how you go about things? But there's a lot of push and pull. And the more we deliberate, the better usually the results are for the larger amount of people in terms of who's buying our products, but also within the organization. And that reminded me of another professor that I had at Columbia, Professor David Stark, who had studied specifically what happened when you had very diverse teams on Wall Street. And it might be counterintuitive because you think of people on Wall Street, the traditional thought is, oh, everybody's the same. They all look the same. They all have the same kind of education. Well, it turns out that the more diverse, and when I talk about diversity, I don't just mean gender. I don't just mean race. I'm talking about socioeconomics. We're talking about education, neurodiversity. All of it. The more diverse the teams, the longer they deliberated because more questions would come up and what about this and what about that? But they made more money. They were more productive. The diversity worked better for them. And so Professor Stark, again, decided to see, is this just cultural? Is this just a bunch of Americans? No, he did the same kind of research on the Japanese stock exchange, the Tokyo Stock Exchange, and found the same thing. And for me, in every organization that I've had the pleasure of consulting with, it's been the same thing. And so I started looking at big tech, and is this creative friction truly kind of fundamental to making better decisions for more people and making more money? And the more I inquired, the more the answer came up as yes and yes. And that, again, because of competition, that's not always encouraged, but that's how in the past that they had done very, very well. And then I started talking to some of the R&D labs within big tech whose timelines were less about the quarterly impact of their decisions and more about the longer term and the medium term decisions for the organization and also their, again, their reputation, what kind of technology will they be launching in the next 10 years as opposed to the next 3 months? And their decision making did require much more of that tension, you know, and so being able to see it in a small organization like the organization in which Art and I and our KPI, but also in large organizations, just made us realize that this creative friction was incredibly important. And we don't hear as much about it as we should.
Yeah, it's, I think we all need the silence after this, both of your answers, because there's a lot of things to process. And we are as well machines of minds. My next question, and this all is open questions, but in your introduction, you mentioned you start by machines that make life or death choices. And then you have the very interesting episode and illustration about the moral machine that was built on the trolley problem of looking at morality, coming from an MIT Media Lab experience. And at a certain point, there's a quote that is my next question, and how you see this, that is before the purpose of the book, in the beginning of the book. Our values, and I'm quoting right now from your book, our values often don't align. How then can we expect AI to know what priorities to control for and whose interests to look after? So that is, of course, the biggest question when it comes to AI, and I think is the question your book tries to answer. And I think everyone in the world at the moment that is in technology is trying to answer. So how can we, in a probably humble way, answer to this? Because in the preparation for the interview, Juliet, you mentioned that if you build a unicorn, you need to be increasingly crazy and driven. And I am one of those, because I build already a couple of companies that reach over hundreds of millions of valuation. And I've been working with unicorns myself. So I'm very humble here, because I as well crush a lot of boats, and I crush probably a lot of things on my mind and so forth. But I was educated by very strong moral, because I was educated by priests and bishops. So in my case, I have the heresy present in my mind and probably will be until my last day. So how can we look at this when the world is as fragmented as ever in history, but is as well more probably, because if you look at until the 20th century, and just some macro data for people listening to us. So if you look at the beginning of the 20th century, there was around 1 billion humans. And 1 billion humans, and during the pneumonic, the Spanish flu, there were 200 million people plus, actually 200 to 300 million people that died. So we just got out of COVID, and actually the total toll of deaths was less than, I think, 30 to 50 million people. So we achieved fantastic things, and now we have close to 8 billion people. So as humanity, as a species, we're actually quite successful, okay, if you take all the heaviness that we have. But at the moment, we are actually passing this bridge that is the values that don't align, which was always present. But as well, AI is becoming the next iteration of us. But it's just, if you look at Google Gemini, 20 times more advanced than ChatGPT. So we don't need to say more. And this is actually proven by most of the research. So how can we look at this when the world is so complex? And you mentioned Galileo. And the heresy at the time of Galileo is that he could be killed. At least now, the risk of death, with some exceptions around the world, is smaller. So we still have a lot of positive things. But of course, we are putting another risk that was not necessary. And as well, we have still a lot of inequality. I'm not talking about that and all the risks that we have. Let's focus on the positive things. So if you look at this question that you answer in the book with the principles, how can we actually at least create a positive narrative? Because you are very positive, both of you. And I love that, your energy and your sense of, as well, of social and as well impactful action.
Well, I was lucky enough a couple of weeks ago to be invited to MILA, the Montreal Institute for Learning Algorithms by Yashio Bengio. We hosted a panel together with thinkers from all over the world, multidisciplinary. And it was very much on the heels of that open letter that was signed by Yashio and hundreds of other AI practitioners around the world in terms of, again, putting that moratorium for advanced AI research for 6 months. Well, it is exactly 6 months. We're there. And again, things have not slowed down. Very few people have paused. I think people in Montreal might have paused. But beyond that, I've only seen acceleration. And I think Google's Gemini is a really, really interesting example of that. And at the same time, the positive thing that came out of that conversation at the Mila Institute is that as positive as I was about the technology itself, Yashio and his group managed to scare me. They managed to scare me because here's an AI grandfather. He won the Turing Award in 2018, right? Along with Geoffrey Hinton, who's also now quit his job at Google to tell the world that, you know, this stuff is advancing more than we, faster than we could have ever predicted. And the more, the closer that we look at it, the faster this thing will come to a place where it has surpassed the way that humans think, our ability to even, you know, supervise our own creations. When you've got two people that are not just in the news, but that are literally telling you face to face that these are realities and making it public, we're going to be publishing a paper that should be coming out in the next few months. So I asked for that silver lining. Where is that silver lining? If you deeply believe this, and we're looking at technology that effectively is far scarier than what's out now, and so many people are already terrified, and there are already so many lawsuits around OpenAI and so many other creators of these technologies, the one positive silver lining still sounds terrifying unless you know the outcome. So way back in the day, there was this thing called the Cold War and nuclear proliferation and this fear on all sides that there would be a third world war. This idea of mutually assured destruction, which when you think about it, it's just, okay, that's reasonable. But the extreme that it had to get to for them to even begin to negotiate in those terms, I can't even imagine what those conversations were like. So apparently, according to those that know, including Mr. Bengio, there are currently conversations that are happening between the United States and China with the idea that our technologies will soon surpass us. We're talking in a matter of a few years. We're not even talking decades here. And that fear would allow for some sort of détente where we would not attain the kind of destruction that we can foresee. And so I know it's a terrifying silver lining, but it's a silver lining.
Arta, I completely subscribe on what you said, Juliet. And I have a question on what you said, but Arta, I would like to hear your opinion on this because this is very important. And this is a bit like an open ire moment of AI. But the point is that a nuclear war would destroy simply humanity. The problem, we don't destroy humanity. We create another iteration of humanity because an AI can actually continue as long as they have some technology and some code going on, which is always possible. You even have Mission Impossible, a mainstream film that was about AI. So we actually have mainstream in all levels. Everyone agrees that this is happening as we speak.
Okay, so let's like resolve all this in a few sentences. I always think of Ann Herbert's line, why haven't we had nuclear war yet? Because everybody has that little thing they want to do tomorrow. And she wrote that in the 80s, in the height of the Cold War. AI doesn't have that little thing it wants to do tomorrow. If it gets to the point where it's sentient enough to be, I mean, that's a pretty big leap from where it is now as a tool that, left to its own devices, can do things that human beings can't do. It's already shown that it can do that. The silver lining for me is in transparency. by its name, you know, part of the, it's easy to keep things hidden. John Brunner, back in his novel, The Shockwave Rider, posited a world where nobody could keep anything hidden anymore. And it was both wonderful and terrible. At the time, he said it was wonderful. Now, you know, the more we've gotten into something that resembles that world, the more we realize how terrible that can also be when secrets are revealed. But here we are. One of the consequences of it, I think, is that people are going to have to think really seriously about the outcomes of what they do, the secrets and whether those should be secrets, and about forgiveness. What problems are forgivable? What can be chalked up to the, you know, the limitations of human nature? What cannot be forgiven? You know, do we have a real, you know, you talked about there's no consensus about moral values, and we have the story of the moral machine, which showed that around the world, there's no consensus about the moral values of, you know, when a self-driving car is out of control in advance, what do you tell it about when it, you know, is it going to, when it hits the trolley problem, and it can either hit women or men, when it can either hit people or dogs, when it can either hit older people or younger people, sedentary people or active people, which do we program it to hit? And there is no consensus around the world, or a very limited consensus. We want to hit fewer people. We want to favor people over dogs, and we'll favor pregnant women over others. That's it. Anything else changes depending on where you live and who you are. Well, we're not just asking about self-driving cars. We're asking about every type of technology that could have an effect on people, including subtle effects that we're not even aware of until perhaps years after they happen, like denying us access to an opportunity because of where we happen to live or who we happen to know or what we said 12 years ago or whatever it may be. And sometimes what aspects of this technology are forgivable? What can we move past and what can't we move past? We're going to have dialogues about that as things come to light. We're not going to go right to world destruction right at once. We're going to get there, you know, with steps along the way. And along the way, it's up to us and, you know, people like you, Dennis, and, you know, and all of us to kind of raise the questions of what does this mean? Who does it hurt? Why does it, you know, why is it right or wrong? And how do we forgive?
No, I'm completely with you. So, and Juliet, I think you touch the element of the, I would say, the panic button. So I build AI, and one of the things that I've been finding, for us at the moment, one of the things I'm doing is building a face for AI. It's a bit like what we have in Star Trek, meta-humans that actually can talk with you and engage. Of course, not with all the power of OpenAI and other things. But one of the things I found out was, in the end of the day, actually, my team plays with me. They're all my daughters or sons when I create these new iterations, and they have my real children. But one of the things I've been thinking a lot, because I have moments, Juliet, like I wake up and I feel we're screwed up. And I have other moments when I'm more positive. Probably today I'm in a more positive moment. So one of the things that I was thinking is, I'm a poet as well. I've been writing since I'm 12. And although my poetry is probably not as well known as my technology side, but one of the things that I, if you look at history of literature, you have, of course, according to any historical moment, any civilization, there's lyrics, there's epics, there's tragedies, and there's comedies. And there's tragical comedies or more absurd variations of literature. But in the end of the day, the narratives and the storytelling is always the same. But one thing, for instance, this is actually taken from an interview with the two founders of DeepMind and Google, most of this. And they said one thing very interesting is, if you think that an AI can evolve outside of the scope of the human narrative, it can actually think in a meta way that humans can never think. If you think purely in ideological way and ideas, and we are all writers, so it's easy. We are among peers and my audience as well. I suppose if they listen to this kind of interviews, they're a bit more, I would say, ambitious ideological wise. So, but the challenge is that effectively an AI can become, I would say, a force for good. Probably not in the first iteration, because in the first iteration, probably will be the survival, the fear, which is very unique in human, like you said, the RSE, and then it will destroy to survive and to push forward. But at a certain point, when it reaches a moment that it doesn't need to destroy, probably will be just, if it's purely ideological narrative, and of course, at the moment, most of the AI, because we have two kinds of AIs going on. There's the generative AI, which is based in language, and swarm intelligence. I actually prefer swarm intelligence, but swarm intelligence can be more disruptive because it replicates syndromes of nature. If you look at the bees, if you look at the ants and so forth. So, and there's a lot of different elements of AI intelligence. So coming back here, and that, as well, coming back to your principles, because of course you did a fantastic work, and I don't want to get out of focus, is that, and I think picking in your extreme, Juliet, because I panic as well when I read these things, and when I, even me, for instance, I can disrupt a small country, or even a big country, let's put it out that way. For instance, I have a friend of mine that, and I will say this probably for the first time public, but I think, bear in mind what you said, Juliet, I want to share this as well. For instance, one of my friends, I don't mention names, was the person that train the team that became the social media team of Trump. And I remember when we started using Twitter, and it was mostly Twitter, let's put it that way. But when I started using, I thought that anyone that used Twitter for the things that were done, it would go to jail straight away. And unfortunately, it was behavior, that behavior, and the person that trained never thought that there was use for that, because probably has some nightmares sometimes. But I'm just saying is that this happens sometimes when you put it out of context. And of course, there's short term, medium, long term. So on these principles of humanity, and humanity will never learn, let's be honest. I sometimes there's moments, today I'm more positive, but moments where I think we are just a swarm intelligence that just wants to destroy everything and move forward. There's a sense of kind of organic self-destruction, because we want we need the desire, we have fear, we have passion, we have hate, and all these different things. But to the book, and coming back to the book, my question is, to summarize, I know that we passed almost 1 hour and a half, is how can we summarize the principles? Because what I love about your book is the simplicity, and the, as well, that the morality and the values, and if you see the chapters and the way you organize, is you are in the logics of power. That is one of the chapters, the four logics of power. Be intentional about risks to humans, and we touched this during the interview. And then as well, the favor loosely coupled systems and embrace creative friction. We should touch art, but this part is very important, because if you look at creativity, and that's where it comes, this my first part of this question, is that creativity has been always what is unique to human, but is creativity for good and for bad? Because sometimes you are creative, destroying economies to create new civilizations. So from this, and it's a big question, I'm just brainstorming with you, is how would you synthesize the values, the seven values that you brought to the book, but as well that open in a way that for people building technology, and especially people that have a sense of conscience, because I think everyone... There's one thing that everyone in humanity respects is our families. Okay, whatever you hate them or like them, everyone has love for their parents, for their mothers, for their children. And whatever you're Russian or Chinese or Ukrainian, you all love your parents, or you might not even love them so much or less, but you have a sense of connection. And this sense of connection is what bounds us as humans. So how do you see this in these principles, and as well in the corporate part that brings that you touch a lot of things about the data rights, the question bias, and all these things that are part of the work of technologists around the world and AI personalities and entrepreneurs?
Art, I'd love to hear your answer on that. So I'm going to let you keep thinking. Art has his thinking face on. You can tell. Like he's been like off like this. It means he's deep thought. There's a lot going on there. So I want to give you that opportunity. But first, I also want to address something else that you said, which is the panic. I think part of not panicking is realizing that these longer term potentials of AI are just that, potentials. They're not necessarily set in stone. And I think that it's really important to remember that the first way to stop that potential harm from happening is to start setting regulation now. How do we actually want our systems to behave vis-a-vis each one of us? And if we can get that piece figured out, I think it'll go a long way in terms of making sure that the horror stories, the longer term fears don't actually happen. that those two things are two sides of the same coin in many ways.
Yeah, I can follow that. I totally agree. I think the EU, with its four categories of risk, you know, minimal risk, limited risk, which means basically a chatbot should not pretend to be human, high risk and unacceptable risk, is creating the right kinds of conversations. There's going to be a lot of disagreement about which programs belong in which projects belong in which categories, but that's the right kind of question to ask. Why is this thing unacceptable and that thing acceptable or minimal? I think that there will be a lot of work on AI auditing. And then I was thinking, what do I say about this that sums it all up? And ultimately, I'm going to go back to something I've said before. So, you know, Dennis, you said earlier that, you know, your AI face that you're creating is your children. But so you may not have, you know, physical human children. Maybe you do. I have three daughters, and maybe if you're nodding, so you do, and maybe your experience is like mine, because when my oldest was an infant, I thought, I've got this. I'm going to be a great dad. I know just what to do. She's sleeping. She's so small. And then she got a little older and her sisters came along, and I realized, I don't know what I'm doing at all. I'm going to have to learn as I go. And now we've got this thing called artificial intelligence. And there are, as you said, 8 billion of us, of whom, you know, probably at least close to a billion are probably implicated in some way, affected by it or using it or developing it, and more will come. And we don't agree. And this baby is growing fast and it's getting into trouble, and we're responsible for it. And we're going to have to learn on the job what to do and what not to do, and how to train, not just in a technical sense, but how to train the humans who are making the decisions about it. And we're going to have to do all this really fast because its growth is accelerating. And at the end of the day, when you're a parent, you know, you have to be, I think you, it's very rare that I think people regret being parents because of what they have learned along the way. And that's where I get hopeful for humanity. We haven't had this kind of common problem yet. And it's the kind of problem that leads us to learn on the job, as it were, but, you know, or on the reality. And maybe that will work out well. If it doesn't, well, you know, see you in the alternative reality. See you in the Matrix.
Well, I love that. And I am a father of real children. So I feel it deeply. but I think picking in what you marvelous, and it's been a fantastic podcast. I would say that definitely is a lot in our end still. I think like you said, the Juliet and new artist, we are still, there was actually I saw an alternative that you can create an AI to manage the other AI. so it's in the end of the day, if you have a child that goes wrong, you can all create another child. So, so of course I'm being a bit ironic, but the principles are important. And I think this talk is about how we keep the principles, because in the end of the day, whatever you create, there are principles that we cannot, there's a no-go. And I think that's the part that we have to work and be quite active. And as well, to summarize, I have much more questions. I probably will let you rest a bit, and probably I might come back to a part two. But I would just synthesize, definitely, I have my notes here. So definitely, I think for people listening to us, I will just repeat the seven principles of AI. It's really the AI dilemma, seven principles of responsible technology. Please get the book, Juliet Powell and Art Kleiner. The book is available in Amazon. You can find it in any place. But what is important here is research about these two wonderful people. And I just met you, but it's wonderful to engage, because I see your humanity, and there's a lot of it. And as well, for people listening to us, okay, there's much more in your actions. I think we touched about, especially something very big for me is digital literacy that you touched, Juliet. And Art, you mentioned as well the sense of friction or creative friction that we have to understand this because it's not going to change. And I think your metaphor of the children and education is that we all learn as we go, but some people have more responsibility than the others. And we have responsibility, all of us. And as well, part of the responsibility is act, because if you don't act, things will happen. So I don't know if you want a last quote or a last thing you want to say, because of course there's so much questions I have. I want to just be respectful of your time, and I know that both of you are quite busy people, and I appreciate the time you gave me.
Well, oftentimes we're asked what exactly the AI dilemma is, and without necessarily listening to an hour and a half podcast or taking several hours of reading a book, I think that it's very straightforward. Artificial intelligence in the wrong hands can be harmful, but in the right hands can be beneficial to us all. As somebody who actually makes AI, let it be beneficial.
I couldn't say it any better. I'll just say, you bet. Like she said.
Thank you so much. Very grateful to have you here. I wish you all the best, and let's, like you said, Juliet, let's make this dilemma beneficial, because it's in our hands and it's our child. For everyone listening to us, whatever you want or not is our child. And actually, it's feed of our data, of our feelings, of our emotions. So we have some responsibility and some ownership as well. Both of you have that history as well. Thank you for being here. It's been really a privilege. And I hope everyone loved it as I did. And we'll put all the links to you, to your profiles, to your books, to your research, because I think everyone should know more about you. Thank you so much.